Welcome to Longevity. I'm your host, Natalie Nittam. I'm a nutritionist, a human potential and epigenetic coach, and I created this podcast to bring you the latest ways to take control of your health and longevity. We cover it all, from new technology and ancestral health practices to personalized interventions and a very special interest of mine, peptides and bioregulators. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to the show. I'm Natalie Nittam, your host. Question. What if the biggest mistake in longevity is trying to age like somebody else? Today, I sit down with returning guest, Dr. Sandra Kaufman, to talk about personalized aging strategies, why healthy lab numbers don't always tell the full story, and how stress, hormones, and inflammation may be colliding behind the scenes. Plus, Sandra shares why retirement might be one of the least interesting ideas she's ever heard. For anyone wanting to work with Dr. Kaufman, you can reach her through her website, which is kaufmanlongevity.com. And Kaufman is kaufmann.com. And you can also follow her on Instagram, same name, at Kaufman Longevity. Next up, we'll thank a couple of sponsors that make this show possible, and then we're going to dive right in. I take my sleep pretty seriously. It's basically my favorite longevity tool. But even with a solid routine, cool room, no late caffeine, blue light blockers, the whole nine yards, there's still nights when travel stress or a late workout can throw things off just enough to notice. And this is where Trozi from Troscriptions has earned a spot in my nighttime stack. I'll use a Trochee about 30 minutes before bed when I want to really lock in deep restorative sleep. It dissolves between your upper gums and cheeks, so it works fast and fits seamlessly in my wind down routine. It's much more than melatonin. It's actually very low in melatonin. Trozi is physician formulated with compounds like honokiol and agarikon to support GABA activity, plus adenosine and cordyceps to enhance sleep drive and deep sleep. The CBD, CBN, and 5-TP rounded out for full spectrum relaxation. Each Trochee is scored into four, so you can dial in your dose, quarter, half, or full. Sometimes a little goes a long way. It all depends on what your body needs that night. So if you want to protect and optimize your sleep, not just fix it, head to Troscriptions.com and check out Trozi. And you can use code NAT10 for 10% off your order. Think about that time when your gut feels off. Travel leaves you bloated and sluggish, diet changes cause discomfort, hard workouts throw off digestion, or recovery from stress just takes too long. What's actually happening in there? These everyday stressors challenge your gut lining. When that barrier weakens, digestion suffers, and so does your energy, immune balance, and resilience. Now, this is why Level Up Health created Ultimate GI Repair. Inside each capsule, you will find four next-generation peptides: BPC-157 to signal repair, lorazepam to protect tight junctions, KPV to calm local inflammation, and GHK copper to support tissue remodeling. The formula also includes zinc L-carnosine for mucosal stability, tributyrin to deliver butyrate fuel, and dual form quercetin to modulate histamine and immune activity. Every ingredient is buffered for absorption, third-party verified, and tested above 99% purity. Now, for short-term gut recovery or long-term resilience, Ultimate GI Repair brings everything together in one clean, research-based capsule. To get your hands on a bottle for yourself, go to leveluphealth.com and make sure to use code NAT for 20% off. That's LVLUPhealth.com and use code NAT. Dr. Sandra Kaufman is back. Welcome back, Sandy. It is such a pleasure to have you here today.
Oh, it is always fun. I love talking to you.
Yeah, well, and you can tell because we have a few podcasts together. So you guys, for the listeners, if you want to hear more about the beginnings, the theory of aging, you got to head on over to the show notes after you've listened to this episode because we've got the links to previous episodes in there. But to kick this one off, let's just talk about what point did, and we've probably, I've probably asked you this before, but it's a good place to start anyway for the people who haven't listened to this, your previous episodes, is at what point did longevity stop being an intellectual hobby, like this kind of little side hustle that you had going on, and become something that you felt responsible to build into a protocol, into a profession, really?
Oh gosh, that is a really actually good question. Longevity started out as a pipe dream about, gosh, I used to say 10 years and now it's longer than that, about 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And, it was just an intellectual curiosity, something that I wanted to figure out. And of course I built the Kaufman protocol, which was why we age from a cellular basis. And then it just sort of grew and grew and grew. And I really had no intention of seeing patients, but they started pounding on my doors.
It'll happen.
Right? Like, can you come see me now? Like, I don't really have an office, but so now I have an office. And then I would started seeing patients online because they're like, well, now we're in Europe. Can we, anyway, whatever. So there was no actual moment. But now it's gotten to the point that I do see patients in Miami. I see patients in Las Vegas. I run Club Exosome and I have a huge online sort of practice just because it's what people want.
Yeah.
And I have lots of different things available. I have a deal where people can just call and ask me anything they want for half an hour, or I can do full on consults, sort of whatever people want, I'm available for.
It's one of those cases where an interest grows into a passion. And because it's the right thing at the right time with the right people being you, it just takes on a life of its own, right? I feel like in your case, it just organically blossomed because it's just what people needed. And your take on it is so unique that people gravitate towards it. It's actually one of the most amazing things. Like, you didn't sit there and go, because you had already like a great career. Like, you had a big giant job and you loved your job and your big career. But this was like a tractor beam that almost drew you in. You had no power to resist, kind of thing.
No, it's funny you should say that, but that's exactly what it felt like. Yeah. And in fact, I still sort of work two jobs because I do like all of my jobs. I really do. And I don't want to say goodbye to anesthesia or leadership. And I love longevity. And people talk about we get to our age retirement, and the idea is baffling to me, right? Because I am so obsessed with unraveling longevity and sharing that information that I think that I will be doing it as long as I possibly can.
Yeah, no, it's a funny thing you bring up retirement, because when people talk to me, and I'm getting close to the age where people are retiring, and I kind of look at them funny because I'm like, but what do you do all day? like, how do you stay engaged? And I mean, look, some people, they volunteer, they sit on boards, they stay engaged. But you also see people who, I don't know, it's like things get smaller. Their life gets smaller, their expectations get smaller. And I feel like you start to kind of turn in a little bit. So look, retirement can look very different for different people. And maybe I'm sure it can be very rewarding. But I do think that being intentional around retirement has a lot to do with your longevity and health span.
Well, no, I think it's mindset, right?
Yeah.
And what's humorous, so I'm single, right? I'm in the middle of an ugly divorce, so I'm hoping that I'm single.
working on single.
So it's really interesting. So people my age, and I'm meeting a lot of new people my age, and now one of my things I never thought I had to put in my dating ask was vision for the future.
Mm-hmm. So important, right? It's got a match.
Like when you sit there and the guy goes, I want to go play golf all day. I'm like, yeah, this is not going to work out for me. But with the longevity world and with us planning to be, 100, 110, 120, when you hit theoretically 60, and I'm not quite there yet, but as soon as I am, that's halfway.
Yeah.
We have so much more time and so much more learning and so many exciting things to do. That it's just a different mindset.
Yeah. And you're also building on a foundation, right? Like, I mean, you've have all this experience, all this time you've put in many ways, this is the time to kind of take it to the next level. So, okay, let's talk a little bit about the moment that you realized that most longevity conversations were actually missing the point because they just aren't personalized enough. And because everybody's talking about longevity right now. I don't know what the next big buzzword is going to be. Currently, it's all about longevity and all the people that want to be fancy say, and health span, of course, because we just don't want to live longer, blah, blah, blah. But you got to a point in your work where you're like, you know what? This people are missing the mark. This is not about a protocol for 50-year-olds or 50-year-old men or 50-year-old women.
No, you're absolutely spot on. So what I started life, for those people that don't know me, as a cell biologist. Mm-hmm. And so I love cellular function. And if you look at cells are clearly why we age, cell failure, because everything that we are cell products, and then throw in some water. And cells fail for very, very particular reasons, which was the basis of the Kaufman protocol. And the cell doesn't hit 50 and go, oh, I'm done now. it slowly unwinds and different things fail at different times for different reasons and, you know, under different conditions for different people. And the whole point of sort of unraveling this was taking it apart bit by bit by bit, trying to figure out what failed first and for whom, right, under what conditions, which meant the personalization of longevity is crucial. Crucial. Yeah. So I have 35-year-olds that, you know, are on a variety of things just based on who they are, what their family history is. I have 45-year-olds on some stuff. I've got some 80-year-olds on some stuff. Everyone is different. And you're absolutely right. I sit there and I personalize every longevity protocol for that person.
Yeah. No, and it makes so much sense, right? Like your life experience, your lifestyle, the gaps in your system, which are going to be different than the gaps in the other system. Like, it still blows me away, the generalizations that still get made every single day, everywhere you turn, about this is good and that is bad. Mm-hmm. Right? Like even when it comes to, like, I just read an article in some magazine about cholesterol, right? And this guy was like, there's no such thing as good cholesterol. I'm like, really? I don't know. I mean, he admits that it's a component of cell membranes. He admits that it's part of the brain. But at the end of the day, he's like, there's no such thing as good cholesterol. And I'm like, that is such an oversimplification that lacks so much nuance and is so misleading. And this was like a mainstream magazine. So the people reading this are running to the doctor saying, where's my statin? He's like, statin is the biggest gift you can give to yourself on your 50th birthday.
Wow. And that you're right. That's absolutely scary, right? Because yeah, cholesterol is necessarily it's a component of every cell, and of course you need it. And your LDLs and your HDLs are simply mechanisms for which you travel.
You carriers.
Around. Yeah, it just carries stuff around the body, right? And if you can't carry it around the body, then you will die. So you absolutely do need to have it. The question is not if you have cholesterol or if it's good or bad. I would argue that it just shouldn't be oxidized.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's my big push. Everyone needs to get their oxidized lipid levels measured. And then I put people on astaxanthin and squalene to try to prevent that. But that's sort of not the conversation. The point is, you're absolutely right. Cholesterol is not good or bad. It just is. And we have to deal with it. Statins are not good or bad. They just are, depending again on who you are. Yeah. I personally don't like statins. Because if you don't have cholesterol, you don't have a whole lot of things that are sort of important downstream. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, when it comes to lipids, rather than decreasing the creation of cholesterol, I like to increase utilization with the other drugs. So the fenofibroids as an example, you utilize them instead of making less, and it makes a hell of a lot more sense, right?
What's a fenofibroid do?
It's a PARP alpha activator. So you're going to burn off lipids preferentially versus glucose.
Oh, that sounds like a cool thing to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So, and you're not shutting down. So, because that is the thing I didn't even mean to go to cholesterol at all today, but part of it is, you know, this whole argument of, well, your body makes what you need. Sometimes your body makes too much. The whole argument against dietary cholesterol. So with the fenofibroid, is it possible to say what we want to do is burn off the excess? We don't just want to burn off all the cholesterol.
Like, absolutely. I mean,
it's basically a dosing issue.
Absolutely. And one of the interesting things that changes as you age is your selection of fuel choice, right? Because you're basically, the three choices are glucose, lipids, or proteins. Depending on availability and then depending on age, your body chooses one.
Right.
And as you get older, you're less likely to use lipids, so they accumulate. So if you sort of force your body to use them, you're better off.
Yeah.
You know, the other side is going to say, well, then you're going to have hyperglycemia. And the answer is we can fix that. That's easy. It's far easier to fix hyperglycemia than high cholesterol, I would argue.
And I think what you just said is really interesting. There's something in there that's really important, I think, for people to understand, is not only is personalization to the individual important, but it's understanding that there's even personalization at different times of your life.
Oh, yes.
For you. Like, the needles are going to move. The need to address different issues, your fuel utilization. I mean, ask any woman who's gone through menopause, everything went sideways. And it's not that it went sideways. It's just that things changed and nobody got the memo.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, without a doubt. In fact, this is really interesting since I'm on an estrogen kick at the moment. I did not appreciate, even young people, when you are going through your menstrual cycle, your cholesterol is so tuned in to your estrogen levels that depending on when you draw your levels, your cholesterol panel changes through your estrous cycle.
Oh, really?
It's truly, truly amazing.
That is amazing.
Which I did not realize, right?
And it's an adaptation, right?
Of course it is.
Like it's an adaptive response. This is not a flaw. This is not a problem.
No, absolutely not. It's designed so that if you're going to have a baby, you will have more cholesterol available. That right. makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And you're right. When you have menopause, it all sort of goes wonky. So I'm a big proponent of hormones. The question is which ones, when, how much, you know, whatever, whatever. And I'm in the middle of sorting all of that out. And I think it's not as straightforward as people sort of, at the moment, they have one size fits all. And I think that's not the answer. So yeah. I don't want to spew out one size fits all because I haven't gotten there yet.
No. And I think if you listen to people in the hormone space, the ones that are really kind of doing the work clinically and reading the data, the message I'm hearing is exactly that. The same delivery system doesn't necessarily work for three or two different people.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so there's an issue on delivery system. Which one is your body going to accept better? What's going to work better for you? And even dosing is kind of, it's all over the map. And I think where it gets complicated, where it's simple for me and where I think the danger signs should lie for people listening is when you find these people that make blanket statements and plant a flag on a hill and are ready to die on that hill, come hell or high water, I would take a breath and pause because, you know, they may have written a book. it becomes a line, right? Mm-hmm. And I do think that, you know, and we can talk about the Kaufman Protocol, about the system a little bit in this, because it comes back down to this, where your Kaufman Protocol system allows people, like it's a numerical system, and you get to prioritize things depending on where you're at. And I think with hormones, you'll probably develop a similar system, right? Where it's going to be if you blah, 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 or whatever the case may be, and it's going to become a matrix. Mm-hmm. And a matrix is very different than a system. So maybe speak a little bit about the Kaufman Protocol. Because what it does, it explains why we age, to your point, what you said earlier about the cells. What was broken about the existing frameworks that you were saying, basically?
Yeah. So when I got into longevity, there were a few discussions about the hallmarks of aging, which was a laundry list. I think at the time there were seven things, and I don't know what there are now, 13, 12, 15, I sort of lose track. But it dawned on me that it was extremely disorganized. Seemed like there were categories and some categories, and there was no organization to it whatsoever. So mm-hmm. I started from scratch. And I said, well, I think that you age in seven categories from cell perspective. Category one is things that go wrong with your DNA. So this would be epigenetics, telomere misfunction, obviously usually getting shorter, but there are other issues that go on with your telomeres, and then heterochromatin distribution in your nucleus. So lots of things going on in your DNA. Two is mitochondria. Seven things roughly go wrong in your mitochondria. Three is going to be pathways. This is going to be AMP kinase, mTOR, your seven sirtuins. And then last year I threw in your circadian rhythms because that's an extremely complex pathway that gets sort of screwed up over time. Let's see. Four would be quality control. So this is repair mechanisms. So you have four DNA repair mechanisms. You have your whole proteostasis system. And autophagy is in there because when you can't fix it, you can recycle it. Let's see, five is your immune system that becomes your inflammasome over time, which you very well know. That's how I got obsessed with mast cells, because I think that's a big deal in that category.
Yeah.
Six is individual cell requirements. So this is the idea that you need to take care of your stem cells. You need to get rid of your senescent cells. Brain cell needs something different than a red cell, as an example. And then seven is waste management. And this is mostly glucose issues, as well as accumulation of lipofusion. So if you accept the fact that those are mostly the reasons that you age, right?
Yep.
Then what I did is I said, well, which categories represent which diseases? And it's easy to say, for example, diabetes is going to be category seven. It's waste management. A lot of cancers are going to be DNA repair mechanisms. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of mitochondrialopathies. That's obviously category two. So depending on who you are, what diseases you have, what runs in your family, you would pick things that basically address those categories. And then there was a rating system looking at, oh gosh, I think I'm up to 70 now, pharmaceuticals and supplements, rating them in those categories on a 0 to 3 scale. So they all come with a 7-digit barcode to tell you exactly what they do and how well they do it. So you can individualize your supplement and your medication protocol based on data.
Yeah.
There you go.
You know what I love about you? One of the many things I love about you is you dip your hand in both pools. Was there anything that you think you got wrong in your earliest thinking about aging before you built the current model that you're using?
I think I was a little bit simplistic in that I think that everything is cell-based, because I think that I need to create something that, you know, like when you watch Star Trek, and here's a bizarre illusion. Like, we play chess or checkers on one board, and on Star Trek, there's like 3 boards.
Yeah, it's 3-dimensional.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think what I have to do is add the extra planes.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's cells, and then there's tissues and organs, and I kind of ignored those, and I think it's time to add those back.
Yeah. Just operating at the cellular level doesn't take into account the downstream effects that are going to happen, and you kind of have to follow it through to its natural end to see what the full effect is. That totally makes sense to me. So you've said that there's no single optimal strategy for everyone, hence the personalization.
Correct.
So what are the most common ways people harm themselves by copying somebody else's perfect stack?
Oh my gosh. I mean,
where do I begin?
That's an unanswerable question. Oh my God. I get 20-year-olds coming in on massive doses of NAD. I mean, I get crazy, crazy stuff. And I look at these people and I'm like, okay, no, let's start from the beginning.
Yeah. Can we?
Right? Please? They all want to be Brian Johnson, and they don't understand that, like, that's not the goal. Right. The other really interesting thing is I get all of these people that come in and they want to be super, 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 super thin. Mm. Right. Like the newest pictures of Demi Moore, anorectic out, you know, and that is just not longevity. That is not healthy. I'm sure she's going to like have horrible osteoporosis issues. She's clearly got sarcopenia. She is not going, this is not going to end well for her. So I think that things that people hear and see on social media is just not great when it comes to understanding longevity.
Yeah. And I think the other side of that coin is also a bit of a pitfall, right? Wanting to be fully muscle bound into old age. Like, I think there's a, with muscle, there's a sweet spot as we age, like, because you can't be just pumping growth hormone from somewhere else or whatever it is, because you want those great big juicy muscles that you had in your 30s. That may not serve you, right? There's the whole issue of mTOR and AMK and that little balance.
Yeah. Well, even at the more basic level, the more muscle you have, the more your heart has to work to supply blood flow to that muscle.
Yeah.
Right? You do that for 60 years, you end up with a cardiomyopathy. So, right? So again, this is there's the cellular level and then there's the organ level, right?
Yeah.
So we do have to look at all of these things sort of in conjunction. And you're right. So I think a reasonably normal body habitus is the way to go. You want to be lean, you want to have some muscle, but you don't want to be on the crazy side of the bell-shaped curve.
Yeah, no, 100%. So if we're looking at the systems that drive aging, do we have, you know, if we look at metabolic, immune, the vascular system, neurological, hormonal, detox clearance, is there one that really stands out on the aging?
Oh gosh.
I mean, they're all important, obviously. I'm not asking you to pick a favorite child. I'm just saying.
Well, the problem is that it depends on the individual.
Yeah. Okay. I'm glad you said that.
It really just does, because some people walk into my office and, oh my God, you know, they are a cardiovascular disaster.
Right.
Other people, it's all immune. They look like the most inflamed humans I've ever seen. So it just, I think it's very individual based. That being said, I think there's a lot of things that we even haven't identified yet. And you know me, I love going after the zebras.
Yeah.
Right? And
coming up with the occasional unicorn.
Well,
yes.
Exactly. Yeah, I think I'm on the unicorns right now. But, you know, when I stood in front of everyone and said, you need to bleed yourself, like back in the Middle Ages, like I wasn't kidding.
Interesting.
Iron overload is a huge deal.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I interviewed somebody about that. Her husband almost died before anybody figured it out. And I think she was the anybody who wasn't even a doctor.
Yeah. Well, even normal people, right? When you are constantly bringing in iron, your digestive tract, you know, it's in your food. Every living thing has iron in it, right? It's the most abundant atom in the universe, essentially, right? You're bringing it into your body and it sits in your intestinal wall. And that intestinal wall decides, that cell, the enterocyte, am I going to keep this or am I going to throw it away? And if it doesn't want it, the cell sloughs off and you poop it out, right? But most of the time it gets taken into your body. And once it is there, there is no turning back, right? With the exception of menstruation.
Right.
Women dump blood up until menopause and then we stop. Men never dump blood. There's no way to get rid of iron. Zippo zero.
Right. So you're not even talking about hemochromatosis here.
No,
you're talking about,
I'm talking about normal
the bioaccumulation of iron as a natural process.
Yeah, as a normal, okay. normal thing. And what's interesting is there's a great study, and I do a presentation, I think it came out in 22, and you can see iron accumulation in brains.
That can't be
good. As you look at the years, right, you just see it accumulating. It accumulates in your heart muscle. It accumulates in your bone. It accumulates everywhere. And your body just keeps stashing it away because it doesn't know what else to do with it. And the problem is that iron, of course, donates electrons to oxygen, right? That's how we get radicals. And it destroys you and it triggers all sorts of terrible, terrible inflammatory reactions. The oxidative stress from iron overload is ungodly. And the only way to get rid of it is to either take a chelator or to dump blood.
Easier to dump blood.
Of course it is.
Way easier. Don't need blood. So, but there is, but again, you're going to have people running low for whatever reason.
So again, right? It's personalized, right?
Yeah.
But the other thing that's really interesting is when we measure iron levels in people, we check your blood. Right? As people go, I'm anemic because that's what my blood shows. But what your blood doesn't show is what is stored around your body. And the only way to actually measure that is with a special type of MRI. I think it's like a T2 weighted something, something. And people don't look for it because they don't think about it.
Is it easy to get?
If you ask the right people,
it's easy. It's like using Perplexity. Yeah. Ask the right question.
No, exactly. I mean, can I have an MRI? Sure. Right. Of what? My nose, whatever. You actually have to specifically ask your primary and they're going to tell you that you're a lunatic looking for iron overload in your various organs. And you can do it. You can absolutely do it. But what's interesting is you take old people who they've stored all of this iron, then their blood looks a little funny. So they go, you're iron deficient. And they give them IV
iron.
Right? That makes no sense. What you have to do is chelate it to mobilize it.
So then you have to chelate. Just taking blood's not going to be enough.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really, you can't just, if their blood levels are low, you don't want to just bloodlet them, right? Because then they will be low. But if you chelate it, it'll slowly get it out of the tissues and then it'll get it into circulation. And then once it normalizes, then you can dump it.
All right. So when you assess someone, what are the first five questions you ask them that tells you which of those systems you're going to really focus on? Are there specific questions you ask that give you a hint that point you in a direction, or you're just looking at labs and tests and
So it's like taking a medical history. I'm sure you've been to the doctor. Everyone's been to the doctor. And the first question is always, why are you here?
Which should be.
Right? Why are you here? And if you go to a normal doctor, they're going to say, my nose hurts. My ear hurts. Whatever. When you go to a longevity physician and I say, why are you here? They're going to tell me that their mother has Alzheimer's. They're going to tell me that they're concerned about colon cancer. They're going to tell me that they don't have as much energy as they used to have. Right? And that's why they're there. And that's what we focus on. Yeah. Once we have that main goal, then I go from head to toe. Well, tell me about your hair growth, right? Because people's hair suffers over time. How's your brain? How's your thinking? How's your memory? How's your eyesight, right? You go literally head to
Top
toe.
Down.
And a lot of these things are just absolutely coordinated.
That's really interesting. I think you're only the second person on this podcast that's actually articulated that so clearly. And this was someone who worked with patients who have ALS. And she said, if you spend enough time with somebody's health history, they know mm-hmm. where it started. They know when things shifted. And she said, sometimes I just have to go back and look at the notes if I get stuck. And usually I'll find the answer in the notes. It's really, it's a, such an interesting take. And unfortunately, in conventional medicine, not only are people not trained, but the system disables them from being able to even do, even if they were inclined to do it, the system will punish them, literally. Going back to the epigenetic tests, now more and more of them are developing these organ system clocks. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? Because it seems to me that maybe, and I don't know how accurate they are, one thing that you said, don't be jumping around from one test to another. Like if you are going to use one of these tests, pick a team and stick with it, because it's like a scale, right? Mm-hmm. Your scale at home could be flawed. Doesn't matter relative to yesterday. Are you heavier, lighter, whatever the case may be. With these epigenetic tests, now with the organ system clocks, do you think that there's any value where, I mean, sometimes somebody will get told, look, these clocks are really good, but your brain and your immune system, that clock's looking a little wonky in terms of giving, pointing in a direction or dropping a breadcrumb to point you towards, maybe these are the systems you really want to pay attention to.
I mean, possibly.
Yeah.
I have not found it completely useful. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, I think people that are sort of not in the know like them.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to measure this from home and then something sort of pops up, it may be the thing that brings you to the physician's office to try to figure it out. And so I'm sure it can be quite useful. But I think the most important test, since we're talking about tests, is going to be the liquid biopsies for cancers.
So that's an interesting topic. Let's talk about that, because there's a few of those tests around. There's been smoke and mirrors and noise and arguments and all the things.
Yeah. And so, you know, the first one that came out was was Grail.
Yeah.
And I've heard things that maybe it's accurate, maybe it's not so great. It is evolving very, very, very quickly.
I think that's the thing to remember, right? Like, they're not perfect.
I think that right now it may not be the absolute answer, but give it 5 years, it will be the answer. I think it's going to be the end of the colonoscopy and the boob squishing and all of these ridiculous things. I think that's what you're going to get once a year. And then if anything shows up on it, then you go in for some sort of actual, you know.
Further. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, that makes sense. I do. And look, we've all heard of people who have found things from these tests. The problem is there's a lot of either false positives or such early results that it sends, the system's not equipped to that kind of early detection, mm-hmm. where your doctor is going to say, you got nothing, man. I'm not seeing anything. And the problem is now, as an individual, you may be left with this anxiety that says, well, the test says there's something really early going on. My doctor says there's nothing we can do. How do I sleep at night? And maybe that's the thing that should send you back to the basics and say, okay, what can I do to support my body so that if there's something there, it doesn't go to the next level, which is where you come in.
Yeah, no, absolutely agreed. Yeah.
And that's where you can kind of jump in. So where do you see people pushing the gas, like more interventions when they actually just need the breaks?
I think this is such a crazy trend right now that people don't understand it. Well, and I think what really drives me nuts, and I am on social media, but I don't do that much myself, but I sort of like watch it. And what pains me to the nth degree is all of these things that say, be a longevity specialist, get training in 3 days, and you will make $1 million.
And you see that?
Oh my gosh, yes.
And you know why? Because it's such a hot trend.
And I just want to kill myself, because you can't learn how to be a longevity physician in 3 days, let alone a year, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's impossible. It has taken me 12 years on top of my entire medical education to figure this stuff out.
Yeah.
Right? You can't communicate it to someone in 3 days, right? And longevity is not pushing hormones to make people like feel jacked up. That is not longevity. And it absolutely pains me. And, you know, but I see this all the time. In fact, I got on a podcast, and I don't want to cite any names, but there was a gentleman that I highly respect, and he invented or came up with a combination drug thing, or not pharmaceutical, like a supplement thing to help certain. See, if I say anything, then you're going to know exactly.
Yeah, I know. So we don't want to know. Just
anyway,
tell us.
Point being is I wanted to hear his lecture. So I got on the podcast as just a regular viewer. And the first thing out of like the guy's mouth, not the lecturer, but the guy who's developing the product said, you know, if you sell our stuff, you're going to be a millionaire. We're going to give you such and such percentage of markup. And this is the best scheme ever.
So it was like a webinar or something.
It was a webinar to advertise to clinicians to sell this product so that they could get rich doing it.
Right.
And it pissed me off so badly. I'm like, I am not in longevity to make a ton of money. I'm in longevity to help people.
Yeah.
And I think that that is just the rationale that a lot of people are using to jump into a specialty that they don't know about and they don't understand. And I just worry that's going to hurt a lot of people.
Well, they're commercializing it, right? I mean, what they're doing is they're doing that thing called scaling, right? When you go into a program to build a business, they're like, how can you scale what you do? And if you can build my next question is about the stack trap. Right? Like if you can build a stack that you can pitch that says that anybody who takes this stack supposedly is going to positively impact their aging process and longevity, then you have the $1 million idea. So how do you handle the stack trap? Like, and so there's two sides of the stack trap. There's the pre-made stack, which we've already established, 27 Ways to Sunday. Probably not a great idea. Maybe it'll help you a little bit, but it's not going to really do much. Versus the other stack trap where personalization becomes this like endless optimization and starts to create more stress load than benefit. Like how do you, like you mentioned earlier, you're on a whole bunch of different meds and things. How do you know how to draw the line, or are you cycling through different stacks at different times, which I think is probably the approach that makes sense to me other than some foundations, but let's talk about the stack trap.
Well, I mean, there's a difference between what I do and what I do for other people.
For sure. Yeah, no, you have capacity to do things that a lot of people wouldn't. I've been to dinner with you. I've seen it.
Right, right. And I do take a lot of things, but you're right. I do cycle them. I do take days off. I do, you know, one month I'll take this drug, the next month I'll take that drug that do slightly similar things but not the same. Try to optimize, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What I do for other people is I tend to see them every 3 to 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I want them to do the same thing for 3 to 4 months, and then we talk about it.
Yeah.
What are you feeling? Do you want to go down? Do you want to go up? What do you think is causing you problems? Blah, 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 blah. And we'll make adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
And because there's always going to be adjustments in longevity. You know, this is not something that we know everything about all the time. So as we learn new things and as we see new things, things are going to evolve and they're going to change.
Yeah.
And some people report amazing changes with certain supplements and other people don't. Other people say, you know what, I can't do this. My stomach hurts. Fantastic. Let's try something else. But I don't want people going in, out like nuts. So I do it on a 3 to 4 month schedule.
Yeah, and that makes sense. It makes total sense. And do you look at labs every 3 to 4 months to any degree? Because obviously you're asking them, how do you feel?
Right, right. So it depends on who they are.
Right.
Are we treating something? Are we not treating something? So for an example, if someone comes in with dyslipidemia, right,
mm-hmm.
we decide how we're going to treat it. And I usually start with non-pharmaceuticals because people prefer that, right?
Yeah.
We go with black seed oil because it has thymogen and there are a couple other things you can use to reduce it or play with your PARP alphas and betas and gammas. And if that works, great. But the only way you're actually going to know that is to check with labs.
Yeah.
Right. So we'll usually try that. And if it's working, we're going in the right way. We stick with it. We adjust the dose. And if it doesn't, we go, okay, let's try a fibrate. If that, you know, works, great. If not, then we go to a statin. But
yeah.
Statins come with all sorts of other things that we have to do.
Yeah.
So if I am looking for something specific, yes, we'll track labs.
Yeah.
Otherwise, no. Right?
That makes
sense. Like, for example, I'll check a hemoglobin A1C, but I'm not going to check your Chem7 because I don't care what your glucose is at a moment. I care what it is over 3 months.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. What's the trend? Okay. Let's dive into one of your recent kind of pet projects, mast cell complex.
Oh.
Mast cells and immune aging. All right. So I had to give you some juice here, obviously. So when you look at aging through an immune lens, what changes first? Surveillance, tolerance, inflammatory tone, or recovery after insults? Or it depends on the person.
Oh my God, that is such a load of, I'd have to go with E, all of the above.
Exactly. All of the above, and it depends.
It does. It's all of the above, right? Your immune system fails so that you get more infections. You can't fight things off. Things that are in remission come out. Tuberculosis, that's why people get shingles, right? You don't really respond well to vaccines anymore. All the things that are good go down. All the things that are bad go up.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes total sense.
Unfortunately, that's just the case of it.
Go ahead.
Right. So mast cells are really interesting because they go up, which means by default that they are the villains in our story. When you do skin biopsies, because it's easier to do skin than anything else, you see a 40 to 50 to even 60% increase over time.
Really?
Yes.
In the presence of mast cells as we age.
Correct.
Okay.
All right. What do mast cells do? Mast cells are packed. They're called Mastzellen, as named by Paul Ehrlich in the 1800s, because under a microscope, they looked stuffed. They looked well-fed because they have all these granules in there. Right. Mm-hmm. So there's a big nucleus and then a ton of granules. And when they degranulate, they sort of release these things and they go everywhere. And it's these molecules that cause just problems everywhere. And they can release like 200 or so different types of molecules, including, but not limited to, because there's a whole lot of them. The one everyone recognizes is histamine,
right?
Which causes all of our immune allergy type stuff. Proteases, chymases, MMPs, all your interleukins, your tumor necrosis factor, again, a gazillion things, right?
It's a lot of inflammatory molecules.
And there's some stuff that's beneficial. Don't get me wrong. They're not all evil. But in general, they're extremely inflammatory and they dissolve things. And my real pet peeve here is the proteases. So proteases, by definition, is dissolving of proteins.
Yeah, it sounds like a digestive thing.
It is. So they release chymases and tryptases, and they literally dissolve stuff. And they activate your MMPs, and that dissolves collagen 1 and 3. So you are dissolving yourself as these mast cells degranulate. And as you get older and you have more, they degranulate more and more and more frequently. And as you have areas of pathology, they accumulate and they degranulate. And you are literally dissolving yourself as you get older. And this is one of the big reasons that, so if you have coronary disease, they accumulate in areas of atheroma, and you piss off your mast cells, poof, you just had a heart attack. They aggregate in your intima of your abdominal wall. So if you have a AAA, an abdominal aortic aneurysm, it causes it to rupture because it's dissolving your tissue.
That's amazing. So how do we stop that as we age? Because this is an aging problem. So this
is
an allergy problem.
Yeah.
This is an aging problem. This is there are two different things.
This person, that person. This is an everybody problem.
Okay.
So you can either... The only thing that you can actually do individually is to block histamine. Mm-hmm. And people are big on that, right? Taking H1 or H2 blockers. Or you can, or what I like to do is stabilize the entire mast cell. And what I have done is I went through, so mast cells degranulate. There's probably 20, 25-ish different receptors on a mast cell causing it to degranulate.
That's incredible.
So depending on the receptor, and the you know, the antigen, different types of things will get released, right? The two main receptors is the IgE, and then the MRX. And then there's a bunch of other ones too. For example, there's a receptor for corticotropin releasing hormone. So you can actually be allergic to stress.
So, well, you know what? That's so interesting you say that, because lately, if I get super stressed, I mean, I've had a thing going on lately. If I get really, really stressed, I've noticed that I can get itchy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, that's ridiculous. You're being hypochondriac. But that now is starting to make sense. It's destabilizing those mast cells.
Your CRH is going to a receptor. You have receptor 1 and 2 on your mast cell. And it causes it to degranulate. So you're releasing histamine and other inflammatory products, and it's causing you to, quote unquote, be allergic to stress. So that is absolutely not crazy.
That's not a good longevity strategy.
No, it's not. You can respond to other things too, like changes in temperature can pass off mast cells, right?
Yeah.
Oxidized LDLs can do it. All sorts of medications can do it. You know, like it's the number of things that can set off your mast cells is astronomical. So as a consequence of that, how do we defeat this? And yes. So I'm big now into mast cell stabilization.
Makes sense.
Right? Mm-hmm. So there's probably a list. I'm about to release an ebook on Amazon. My graphic designer is beautifying it for me at the moment.
Beautiful. Yeah. We want it to be pretty.
It'll be beautiful. Right now it's pretty ugly.
Yeah, it'll be pretty.
And it has probably about 30 over-the-counter agents that are mast cell stabilizers. And it tells you exactly which receptors it stabilizes and how well it does it. Took me a very long time to figure that out. So if you want natural agents, those are in there. And it's stuff like PUFAs and butyrate and PEA and a whole lot of other things. Quercetin, of course, is in there. But it's not as strong as people think that it is.
Yeah. So how do people know, how can people figure out which one they need to?
Well, so the question is going to be, right, is if you have standard allergies, you're going to look for things that say IgE.
Right.
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 If you don't have standard allergies and you still get that pseudohistaminic itch, like, for example, a lot of white women, like I have it, had it, like micrographia, if you scratch yourself and you light up like in red, you can, it looks like fibers attached to you.
Yeah.
That's not an IgE, that's an MRX.
No. Right. 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 So you're going to use a different stabilizer for that than you would for the IgE.
Or you could use combos. Right. So honestly, all of mine are stabilized. I use like, you know, there's even a cannabinoid receptor. So PEA isn't actually a cannabinoid, but it acts sort of as a cannabinoid because it prevents a true cannabinoid from being metabolized. Anyway, so it affects your cannabinoid receptor. So PEA is a stabilizer. And I love that one because it's also does other things, like it's a PARP alpha agonist. Mm-hmm, it's, mm-hmm. It does a whole lot of other things. So one of my new favorite things is PEA.
It's a darling molecule that gets talked. It comes up a lot. And I think
it does a lot
still
of
still figuring out where it, like it seems to fit a lot of different roles.
Yeah, it's pretty useful. It's also considered like a stress molecule as well. So when you are stressed, your body makes more of it. It's a sort of self-protecting, which is kind of cool.
That's cool.
If you take it as a supplement, the bioavailability is terrible, so it has to be micronized. Just as a side note.
Pro tip, people.
In terms of medications. Cromolyn, of course, is the most famous mast cell stabilizer. We use that as an inhaler for asthma.
Okay.
But for longevity, the problem is the half-life is very short, and it doesn't really get systemically activated. So if you just have breathing problems, Cremolin's fine. But for longevity purposes, you needed something that's oral. There are a variety that you can theoretically get, but since the blockade and all the taxes and stuff, you can't. So the only real one that you can get at the moment is Ketaphetin.
You mentioned that to me recently. Yeah.
Yeah. It's an H1 and mast cell stabilizer. It will make you sleepy.
It's a nighttime.
It's a leukotriene agonist. So it also prevents a whole lot of other things. And it's a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, so you get increased blood supply. And it helps you sleep. Some people think it makes you too groggy. So I take a standard dose, if you have like a mast cell true diagnosed problem, is 2 milligrams a day, 1 milligram twice a day, rather.
Talk to your doctor before you go run out and buy it. Talk to your doctor. I just need to say this.
Yeah, I know. For longevity purposes, I have found that like a half a milligram at night is quite nice.
Question for you. Where does resilience actually come from? We talk about mindset, discipline, pushing through, but if your biology isn't backing you up, it's pretty hard to move forward. Now, over the past year, my resilience has definitely been tested in a few different ways. And one thing that became really clear is that energy is everything. If your cells can't produce energy efficiently, everything feels harder, physically, mentally, all of it. And this is why I'm so grateful to have my trusty Timeline gummies powered by MitoPure. MitoPure works by supporting a process called mitophagy, which helps your body clear out old damaged mitochondria and therefore replace them with healthier ones. So instead of just pushing through fatigue, you're actually upgrading the system underneath it. And this is not guesswork. Timeline has spent over 15 years and more than $50 million researching this with multiple human clinical trials behind it. If you're thinking about longevity and building real resilience, this is one of the most foundational places to start. Timeline's clinically proven formula is now available at a new lower price, starting at $99. And you can still get 20% off when you go to timeline.com/Nat. Let's talk about where hormones fit into all this. Like, why do, because we're seeing this, right? I think we're seeing as women go through perimenopause and menopause, they're getting these symptoms and all of a sudden somebody's saying to them, you have a mast cell issue. And they're like, what are you talking about? I'd be one of those people. I don't have a mast cell issue. I've never had a mast cell issue. But it seems that the hormonal shifts really kind of pulls back the curtain and brings out the reactivity.
Well, I think that what we don't realize, because, you know, there's so many things to think about in terms of longevity, but estrogen receptors are everywhere. Mm-hmm. Everywhere.
Yeah.
We think about the standard nuclear alpha and beta receptors, right? But there's membrane receptors, there's MIS receptors, they're everywhere. They're on every cell type that we have, right? They're in your mitochondria. They're everywhere.
It's incredible.
And so as soon as your estrogen goes down and you give more E1 than E2, which happens after menopause, it fails. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at so many problems, right? So then the question is how do you fix all of those problems? So I am trying at the moment, we started talking about this, is try to dissect which receptor types are where, what they do, and what do we use to fix it?
Yeah.
Right? Right now we use the old, like, throw estrogen on everything maneuver, estrogen being usually like an E2 variety, right? Mm-hmm. Some people use E3. I'm beginning to think that E4, which is a placental created version, so you only ever make it when you are pregnant, but it has a lot of the fantastic, it's orally available, the bioavailability or the half-life is like 30 some hours, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. Apparently has a neutral effect on breast cancer issues. So that's off the table. On the other hand, it doesn't really change your cholesterol patterns. So there's going to be, right, there's going to be pros and cons to every type of selection, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, I'm working through that at the moment. So there will be a very detailed algorithm or graph or box or something.
Something's like
this,
coming.
Then that, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da.
I think people do have made this connection, but it's part of the reason why if we want to live a longer, healthier life, and particularly as women, if our estrogen's going to fall off, is going to disappear on us, we're going to have to figure out a way to somehow restore that level to some level so that the whole system doesn't fall apart behind it. Like it's not, and you know, when we're talking about estrogen going away, we're talking about your sleep tanks, your brain fog increases, your anxiety goes through the roof, your skin disintegrates and you get more flares, you might become intolerant to exercise. Like, you know, how do we, and part of it is, in I guess in your world, it's how do I take this apart and figure out what's due to estrogen, what's due to something else. Are the mast cells being driven to the loss of estrogen? Like it sounds insanely complex, and yet you seem to be able to develop these roadmaps that give you these, you know, like these big mind maps. Like if yes, then this, and if no, then oh, we're going to go in that direction, which I guess is part of the genius. But then you turn it into a book somehow.
Well, we'll get there. Estrogen is not in the book right now. The estrogen is.
It's your pet project after
the It is, in fact, my pet project, and it will be a book, and I am working on it. But it is really interesting how one thing does lead to another, right? Because there are estrogen receptors on mast cells as well as 20 other receptors.
Yeah.
And what leads to what? What do you need to replace? What do you not replace? How do you minimize risk? Like, I am retrospectively very upset about the study in 2002, the WHI, that said, you know, breast cancer goes up and everyone stopped taking hormones. Well, what they failed to tell you, of course, is that they started it when these women were in their like late 60s and 70s.
And smoking.
And you know, 1,000 of other variables. And of course they had issues, right? Yeah. So now an entire generation of women is sort of hosed because they didn't store hormones on time. Well, that's ridiculous. Luckily, I was dumb enough. I didn't know about that. I just started my own hormone replacement when I felt like it. And, you know, so I've sort of lucked into it. But the question is what is right, what is wrong. Do we need to, the other thing that no one talks about is cycling of hormones. I actually think that's going to be important. I think that we need to sort of match a normal physiologic cycle, because anything that has a receptor gets up, this receptor gets up and down regulated over time with stimulation, right?
Interesting.
So yeah. I'm wondering, and I'm just hypothesizing here, so some experts can be like, she's full of shit. And the answer is, I might be full of shit. I don't know. But it's possible that long-term estrogen causing problems may have to do with chronic upregulation of receptors. And if we cycle it and that doesn't happen, we may alleviate some of the badness.
Do you know Dr. Felice Gersh?
I do not.
Okay, well, you'll want to talk to her, because I think she's on that train. She's on the cycling train. So she'd be someone to talk to. She talks about that quite a lot. So when you suspect mast cell involvement, which it sounds like you're going to suspect it a lot, what's the first thing you help people to change? Is it the environment and exposures? Is it food triggers? Is it stress physiology? I don't know, supplements, sleep timing. I mean, sleep timing is not necessarily going to be a thing for
So it's going to,
unless you're sleep deprived.
Well, it's going to depend on what symptoms they're having. So if it's allergies or asthma, that's one thing, right? Mm-hmm. If you've got a AAA, that's a whole nother ball of wax.
Yeah.
Right. If you've got IBD, you can sort of change things, right? So if, let me rephrase, if there are things that are surface oriented, you can change what you're near, right? Because mast cells traditionally are on your airways, your gut, and your skin.
Right.
Because it's with the environment. And if you change some of those triggers, then fantastic. Mm-hmm. If the triggers are, they don't reach the organ systems, then you have to just go to pharmaceuticals.
Right. Because you talked about mast cells being involved in cardiovascular disease.
Right.
So now there's not.
There's nothing you can do to alleviate that, right? Other than stabilizing your mast cells.
Okay. That makes total sense. You mentioned quercetin earlier and said it's not all that, but it is widely thought of as a mast cell stabilizer. Mm-hmm. What do you mean by it's not all that? And second, how do you think about it in the broader aging context? Like, where does it miss the mark?
So quercetin is sort of interesting. It does a lot of really good things, right? It's mm-hmm. a fantastic senolytic, and people do use it as a mast cell stabilizer. When I looked into it, I thought there would be just like a tremendous amount of amazing information. And there kind of isn't. Like, it blocks the IgE receptor, it blocks the MX2, and it upregulates something called SHP1. Mm-hmm. But I found 17 other agents that did exactly the same thing.
Okay, so not so special.
So I'm like, right? There's also a sexual dimorphism with quercetin, because men tend to do pretty well with it in terms of allergies, and women don't.
Okay, well, that's interesting. Nobody really talks about that. Our first branch of personalization, right?
Yeah. And so I don't put women on it. I will go through the list of what are they already on, and mm-hmm. what potential things are we already blocking? And then what else do we need to block? What have we not done yet?
Yeah.
Because a lot of the over-the-counter stuff already does do a decent job of blocking it. You know, mm-hmm. like one of my favorite is Aluimodin. It also blocks the IgMX2, you know, and it's fantastic for your gut. So that's a super, super easy one. And women do incredibly well with it. And they like it because it's good for your skin.
Sorry, what is it? Can you say it again?
Aluimodin.
Is that a pharmaceutical or a?
No. So it's part of aloe, but you have to make
sure. Like the aloe plant?
Yeah, but you have to get the modin part in there. Sometimes they separate it out.
Okay. And you can find that?
Yeah.
Oh. Well, I mean, if you're Sandy Kaufman, you can find anything.
You can find anything.
I have learned that. Okay, are we done on the aloe modin? Because I've got more questions.
Yeah, I think we're good. Keep going.
Okay, good. Okay, so let's define what a superager is in your world, because I think that's a term that's coming up, right? And I think it's interesting that the superagers we're seeing now, like the people living to 120, 110 or what have you, honestly, none of them set out to do that. they just kind of did, right? Whereas now you've got a whole crop of people, many of them banging down your door going, I want to be that person. Also, I'd like to keep more of my teeth than they did, and I want to be more mobile than they were. Right. So, but in general, the superagers, like, what do they keep that most people lose? Is it the strength, the cognition, the immune tolerance, the recovery speed, the joy, the social drive? And I just want to say in there, I'm going to interject in there that I read recently that Jean Calumet, which is the woman in France who lived 120 something, she took up fencing at the age of 80, which I thought was really interesting. So what do you think in that whole soup of stuff?
You know, it's got to be a combination of both.
Yeah.
You know, not both, but all of it, right?
Yeah. Purpose, community. Yeah.
It just has to be. Like, it's funny, when I wrote book one, I was trying to figure out exactly what the answer to that question was. And I discovered that sense of humor was very prevalent in these old folk.
Yeah.
You know, because some of them drink, some of them smoke, some are 300 pounds. That's not true, but they're hefty. No.
Well, they're not slim and fabulous necessarily.
No, you know? No, absolutely not. And on the other hand, you know, my favorite lady is the one, the 85-year-old or something, the gymnastics lady who just keeps.
Oh my God, she's a Joan?
I don't know what her name is, but I love watching her on YouTube. Like, she's so inspirational. And then there's the guy that's like 112 who keeps like running like it's the 100-yard dash or something. Mm-hmm. So every year on his birthday, he sets a new record because no one's ever done it.
Because nobody else has done it.
Right. I think that amazes me. But I don't know necessarily if they're doing anything particular because they're just so very different. But I think that the next breed of us that reach that will have done it intentionally.
Yeah.
And we will have learned a whole lot of lessons between then and now. Certainly, maybe we're doing a ton of things that make no difference whatsoever. I don't know. I mean, because no one will know until we get there.
Yeah. And I also think the world we're evolving in is so different, right? I mean, if you look at the people today or in the last 20 years who live to 120 or 110, most of their lives was spent in a very different environment than the environment we're all evolving in right now. So I think part of our recipe is going to have to be mitigating some of the negatives that we're being exposed to that they never had to do. And maybe one of those things might be reconsidering your approach to food and actually eating real food.
Yeah. My God. Okay. You know, the funny thing about that is the whole RLK thing. What is his name? The Kennedy.
Oh, RFK. Yeah.
Okay, sorry. My brain. I'm having a moment.
That's okay.
I mean, he's so ridiculously crazy about the vaccine stuff. But then he says, oh, we shouldn't eat processed foods. And in fact, unfortunately, it's the first normal thing that he has said. And I fear that no one will believe him because nothing else that has come out of his mouth has been real.
Yeah. Well, it's definitely one of the many things that is polarizing people right now to the nth degree. All right, let's leave the political animal off to the side there.
Sorry.
I don't want to go there. I'm a Canadian. I'm going to be neutral, but just not going to go there. So what are the 3 to 5 non-negotiables that you see in Super Agers that are not supplement related? What are if you had to say there's three threads that I'm seeing these people, and obviously they're not supplements because, frankly, I don't think any of them take supplements.
No. Well, no, I mean, I think it's straightforward. I think you need to exercise. And it's not necessarily going to the gym. It's just staying physically busy all day.
Yeah. Right?
And I use my dad as an example. My dad is 85. He's been an endocrinologist his whole life. And he thinks that my longevity stuff, he's now becoming slightly interested now that he's 85. But he lives with his girlfriend on her horse farm and he's a stable boy.
He's busy.
He's
working.
Feeding these horses. He's taken to pasture in and out every day. It is he. And then I called him on his 85th birthday and he didn't answer. So he called me back. He was playing tennis. And he has this team of dudes he's been playing tennis with for 40 years.
Yeah.
And he says that he stays after now because he was running laps around the court because he didn't feel like he was getting enough exercise with these old gomers.
Yeah.
Right. So I think the physical activity is just absolutely mandatory. Right. I think that eating reasonably healthy is extremely important. Mm-hmm. Right. These guys are not eating Cheetos. They're eating like normal stuff and emotional state.
Yeah.
You have to be either funny, social, positive, whatever your mental state is, I think I think those are the three keys.
You know, as you're saying that, I think there's also this mental state piece of not allowing your age to define you, right? Because, I mean, I think of my parents. I mean, they're not playing tennis, but they are. If you saw them walking down the street from the back, you would not guess that that's an 89 and an 87-year-old. Like, it's the way they hold themselves, the way they walk. And frankly, every time I suggest to them that maybe they should sell their condo and go live in a community where there's other people, they're like, well, why would we want to go live with old people? I'm like, you know, by some people's measures, you might be considered old people, but they literally don't see themselves that way. Right. And it's not that they don't want to, it's just that they literally don't.
Mm-hmm.
And I think your dad is similar. He's not saying, oh, well, I've played tennis, I've done enough, I don't want to push myself, I'm blah, blah. He's sitting there going, man, I barely broke sweat. Like I need a couple of laps here. And that's a mindset. That's an attitude that I think, I don't know if we can cultivate it, but it's worth thinking about. Can you cultivate a mindset that doesn't match your age?
Yeah, no, I think it's true. But I think that's how you survive. Although on the other hand, like I want to kill him because it was freezing out there, you know, those last few months. And I bought
full therapy.
And I bought him like a wrap coat because I was worried about him. 85-year-old guy falls down, right? And he's going to freeze and die. But he decided that it was too nice of a coat and he would only wear it on nice occasions.
This is where your plan's back.
And I thought,
right?
You are old.
Really?
I forgot. You are old.
There is that part of you that has that sensibility. Let's move on to controversies. What's the biggest misconception about anti-aging medicine that you wish would just die already?
Oh, God.
Like, what's the thing that every time you hear it, you're like, are you kidding me right now? Like, make it go away.
Rapamycin.
Thank you. Yeah. Why?
Because rapamycin makes mice look really nice in cages.
Which is great if you're a mouse.
It's fantastic. Fantastic. Rapamycin is, as you know, is an mTOR inhibitor. Therefore, it causes or it blocks you to be able to make tissue. Therefore, it causes sarcopenia. It's going to cause hippocampal atrophy. It's going to cause your intestinal wall not to be able to turn over. So you're going to end up with, you know, GI problems because your GE junctions are going to be terrible. So I think that this whole rapamycin thing is a disaster. And people are like, oh, but I only take a smidge every other week. Well, I think until we get like RAPA logs that are specific to, you know, either one or two, the receptors, or we really figure it out, I think it's a disaster.
Yeah. All right. Rapamycin. Off you go. Off stage left. Let's talk about the novelties, the peptides, the exosomes, the stacks, while ignoring the boring fundamentals that really move the needle. Like, and I mean, we see this, right? Because it's kind of like you can throw money at the problem. I'm just going to go get an exosome infusion. And I mean, you're in the exosome.
Well, business. I was going to say, I love exosome infusions. So,
yeah. And I'm not saying they're bad. I'm just saying like the peptides, the exosomes, all the fancy supplements. And especially to people who are well-resourced, they're like, well, I'm just going to buy my way out of the problem.
Yeah. Well,
and what do you say to that?
Well, I think that we create longevity pyramids for people. Mm-hmm. And I think that like any pyramid, the base has to be strong, right? And the base is things that you do every day. And I always say it's diet, it's exercise, it's your supplements, it's your medications. If you're going to do light therapy, blah, blah, blah. It's just stuff that you do every day. And then there's going to be stuff that you do on top of that, right? So for example, I tell people they should get a massage once a week.
What a concept. Yeah.
Right. But the reason I say that, it's good for your brain. It's relaxing. Yeah. Most people, I think, find it relaxing. But it also increases blood flow to your muscle, increases blood flow to your skin, and they stretch you out a little bit. So it's a little bit of joint flexibility. So if you can afford it, I think it's a fantastic thing to do.
Nice.
Right? I think exosomes should be done after the age of 50 or with any comorbidities every month to quarterly. Why? Because as Steve likes to say, it's like carpet bombing. Anything that we've missed with everything else sort of gets taken care of with exosomes.
Nice.
They're not going to do everything, but they're going to fill in the blanks. And they really do make you feel better. You can see and feel the difference.
Yeah.
So I think that's just a wonderful addition.
Yeah.
I think peptides are a bit like spot welding.
Yeah.
I think they're the opposite of exosomes. Like if you have a specific immune problem that everything else hasn't hit, there's a peptide for it. And you're, of course, the queen of peptides. Like if you want a little extra muscle, there's a peptide for it, right? There's a peptide for everything. But you don't build a longevity stack on peptides. I think you use it as a secondary source to fill in the blanks.
Yeah. It's garnish, you know, or it's not even garnish. It's a highlight. Mm-hmm. It's the highlighter that gets laid on top of. You know, I've lost count of the number of people who reach out to me and say, well, as a matter of fact, somebody reached out to me recently, said asking for a friend, they want to feel better and they want to build more muscle and lose weight. So they're asking about, they asked about a growth hormone secretagogue. And I'm like, all right, how old are they? 28. I'm like, get lost. Like, go away. Are they sleeping? Are they exercising? How do they eat? Are they actually like, you know, and it was a man. And I'm like, did they get their IGF-1 levels tested? Even though it's not perfect. At 28 years old, just like you shouldn't need NAD, you should not need a growth hormone secretagogue. You can change your lifestyle. You can change the inputs. Mm-hmm. Your body will make your growth hormone for you. Adding a peptide to it is only begging for trouble.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
I think that that's where it's the danger of peptides right now is, and it's kids. It's a bit astounding. Okay, well, that's the novelties. So you talked about rapamycin being not so great. Is there anything else, any other intervention that seemed to look really good in the short term, but create long-term trade-offs that you worry about? So you talked about the rapamycin. Is there another one out there?
Well, hyperbarics is my big...
Interesting.
Hyperbarics, oxygen is fantastic. If you have pathology, if you need to get oxygen to parts of your body where your vasculature is not great, it's fine.
So if you have a problem. No, right? I love that.
If you have a pathology, so if you are a diabetic, if you have a neuropathy, if you have traumatic brain disease where you get a capillary disease or microcapillary problem, you're not getting oxygen to your brain tissue, hyperbarics can be very, very useful, right? Mm-hmm. However, if you're a normal human at a normal age, and you give yourself extra oxygen, you are destroying your stem cells and you're creating a plethora of free radicals unnecessarily. So it's sexy. People love sitting in their little oxygen chambers, and I think that it will kill them in the end.
But I just love the nuance you put in there, right? Therapeutically, yes, right? Or elderly people who've got like really old people. There was that study that was done that showed it did beautiful things for them. But now we've got a bunch of 40-year-olds running to hyperbaric centers thinking they need to do it every day. I love that. Okay. All right. Just a few more and I will release you. In 5 to 10 years, what will we personalize that we can't really personalize well today? What's your vision or what's your hope?
Ooh, good question. I think we're just starting to understand genetics. And you can get your genetics tested, which will tell you, you know, maybe this, maybe that sort of thing. I've read all of the like methylation reports and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I think in 10 years, that's going to be very specific. And I think it's going to be significantly better.
Cool.
I actually also think that we'll have real testing for longevity questions. For example, I would love to know what sirtuin levels we have. We don't tell people that's for that yet. I would love to know like my sirtuin 1, 3, and 6 level. I am taking stuff for it. Is it actually working? I would love to know what my intracellular level of NAD is in a sickly fashion. I would love to know that, but we just don't, right?
Yeah. So I think we're just guessing right now. Yeah,
absolutely guessing. So I think that sort of thing is going to get a lot better. And I also think that what's going to happen is our supplements are going to be more refined, right? We have a few of them that are doing incredibly well. So for example, I love Rev Genetics and I have no connection with them. I never met them, but I love their products. And they took curcumin and turned it into metacurcumin by putting it in a nanomycel. So the bioavailability is astronomically fantastic. And I think that we need to do that sort of thing with lots of the other supplements such that we don't have to take as much, right?
Yeah, because it actually gets into the cell.
Exactly. We are so overloading our bodies to get some small quantity into our cells. Yeah. What that's doing to our microbiome is really hard to say. I'm sure my microbiome is the healthiest microbiome in the world because I always say that your microbiome are like your children, right? They eat first and you get the remnants.
If you could design the ideal superager clinic from scratch, maybe you will, what would that patient journey look like?
Oh my goodness. Let's see. I think that it would be, I mean, everything would have to be under one roof. Get all of your labs checked, see your physician. You know, I don't know if the gym needs to be there or not, but all the toys would be there, which would be really quite nice. And it's not going to be $1 zillion. I think that's the key. I think if people are building these things and they're just far too expensive.
I love that mindset of yours to keep it affordable. I mean, some of the costs in some of the stuff right now, some of the clinics and the physicians are so stratospheric. Like it's it's hard to get your head around it. You know, when it starts to hit the six figures, you're like, really?
There's just no reason for it. There really isn't.
Yeah.
And, you know, and people come to me all the time with these great, you know, schemes to use my brain to make money. And I'm like, I'm not doing it.
Go away. Yeah. Good for you. All right. What do you want your work to change about how medicine thinks about aging, other than everything?
Everything. Everything. No, I mean, so I think you've heard me say this before. I think about it in three tiers. Mm-hmm. Tier one medicine is what we do now. We wait for diseases to occur and we treat them. Tier two is more functional stuff, right? We test, are you, you know, carrying molds, or do you have too much lead in your blood, blah, blah, blah. It's a lot of testing. And we treat that sort of thing, which is fantastic, right? It's
removal of the bad stuff. Right. Yes.
A lot of toxin, fantastic. Longevity medicine, however, is none of those things. Longevity medicine is knowing what is coming down the pike and avoiding it. And it's in a complete change of mindset. And Western medicine does not have that.
Yeah.
They think prophylaxis is, you know, very simple. Don't smoke, exercise, and eat well. And to a certain degree, that's true.
Yeah.
But it has to be far more advanced than that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and really it requires the whole model to be addressed. And I think it's going to be a while before that anybody's even open to it. I think it's people like you kind of operating outside the system that are going to start to change things.
Well, you know, this is really interesting, just as an aside. So I work in a plastic surgery office. And so I recently had plastic surgery, as you know, and, I did get a little
fabulous,
but I didn't bruise. And I developed my own peri-surgical strategy.
Of course you did.
What supplements was I going to take? When was I going to stop them? When was I going to restart them? When I was going to do the exosomes? And I walked back into the office 2 weeks after surgery and it was like, it had never happened.
Yeah.
And so I'm now working with the plastic surgery, the surgeon, to figure out if we can protocolize this for all of his patients.
100%.
So, yeah. I mean, it doesn't seem crazy, but it seems like something we needed to do a long time ago and just no one did.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the future is coming quickly.
I agree. And people are more open to it. I mean, I have a membership community and just the other day, a woman was going into surgery saying, what do I need to think about? What do I need to do? What can I do before, during, and after? Mm-hmm. And for surgical applications, like this is something that someone like you can 100% troubleshoot, right? I mean, yes, you've got to address the bleeding issues. You don't want to do anything that's going to liquefy the blood or prevent clotting or promote clotting at the wrong time. But these are, for the most part, solvable problems. And then when you add that personalization in there based on the person's tendencies, you get better healing and faster healing. It seems so obvious.
Right. It does seem obvious, right?
It's crazy
I really actually think that some of the people in this office kind of go, longevity medicine, you know, poo-poo, ha-ha, laughing me behind my back. And then when I had surgery, all of a sudden it wasn't funny anymore.
No, all of a sudden they're like, wait, what?
Like, what the hell did she do?
Right? Twin sister?
Maybe we can utilize this.
Yeah, no kidding. All right. We have last two. For the person who is listening to this and is like, okay, this was super awesome. I don't know what to do. What would I do? What are the first three actions you'd give them this week to identify their dominant aging system?
Oh my gosh, their dominant aging system.
Yeah. Like what are three things or questions they could ask themselves or...
Dominant aging systems. That's a really good question. I think the question is what bothers people when they're going to sleep or when they're waking up?
There you go. Yeah.
Right? When you're waking up and you need to get out of bed, what's in your head? Right? Is it, I'm stressed about work? Is it my back hurts? Right? Mm-hmm. Where are my glasses? Because that means you need eye drops. I mean, I guess when your mind is quiet and it's just starting to wake up, what is there first? And that's what we can fix.
I love that. That's really good. Because it could even be those heart palpitations really bug me because that's a condition they recently developed or whatever the case may be. That's a really good way to look at it. I love that. All right. So you may not have an answer to this, but what's the one question you wish I would ask you that almost nobody does? I should have sent that to you ahead of time.
I know. Gosh, I don't know. I think I get asked everything.
Yeah, I know. Well, people want to pepper you with questions endlessly.
I don't know. I guess the one thing I do, it's not really a question per se, is I do get asked when the next book is coming out. And the answer is, it's going to come out in pieces. And I guess this is what we can put out there. I have decided that it takes so long to write books individually that I'm going to start putting out e-chapters.
Yeah.
And the first one is going to be due out as soon as my beautifier beautifies it, my graphic designer. So I'm hoping within a week or two. So I'm not sure it's going to come out. So the first one's going to be mast cell. And then the second one will be the estrogen algorithm that I'm working on. And then I'll probably put out something on iron overload.
Yeah.
So these will be coming out, but in drips and drabs rather than waiting 5 years and doing it all at one time.
Well, and I remember you saying this to me recently. And one of the other reasons you said is because if I wait 5 years to publish the work that I dug into now, it's going to be obsolete or there'll be new information and I'll never put out the book. And I think that's brilliant. Like putting out, not to mention the fact it's easier for people to absorb the information. And then maybe at some point you're going to knit it all together. But I think that's brilliant. All right, Dr. Kaufman, where do people find you?
So
how do we, because they're going to want to find you.
I appreciate that. So the website is going to be Kaufman Longevity.
Kaufman, yeah.
KaufmanLongevity.com. And all my information is on there. I'm seeing patients, as I said earlier, in Florida and in Vegas or online. Or you can come see me at Club Exosome. We do it quarterly. I'm in Vegas, I think, next in the middle of March.
Nice.
I'm easy to get a hold of.
All right. I love it. Dr. Kaufman, thank you so much for your time today. As always, it's a pleasure. And I can't wait to see the books and to see you again.
It is always a pleasure.
Hey, folks, just a quick reminder that all of the information presented in this podcast is for information purposes only. No medical advice, no diagnosing, no treatments suggested here. Before you try anything that you hear about or learn about here, make sure that you check with your medical provider.